So this is Sunday evening, VIMS Sunday evening, January the 22nd, 2017, in case you're wondering. So that gets dated right on the website. So I'm going to read three little quotes first. This is somebody called Sogyal Rinpoche. He's a now deceased Tibetan. We smother our secret fears of impermanence by surrounding ourselves with more and more goods, more and more things, more and more comforts, only to find ourselves their slaves. All our time and energy is exhausted simply maintaining them. Our only aim in life soon becomes to keep everything as safe and secure as possible. When changes do happen, we find the quickest remedy some slick and temporary solution. And so our life drifts on, unless serious illness or disaster shakes us out of our stupor. Does that apply to anybody, do you think? Relevant? Albert Einstein was no Buddhist monk, I tell you, but was very wise, and said, "A human being is a part of a whole called by us universe, universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, his feelings, as something separated from the rest of the universe, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty." Does anybody feel imprisoned in your little sense of self? We often don't think of it as a prison because it's the only thing we know, but then we'll have a moment when, you know, there's just the sunset and suddenly we feel like we're floating free, and then we crash back into our prison. Oh, I've got to take a photograph of it. Keep it for another day, and suddenly we're little again. So meditation, as there's many forms of meditation, many reasons for meditating, many motivations different people have, but as taught by the Buddha, is a method, and there are various aspects to the method, but very subtle and cleverly organized practices, because he was very, apart from being a wise and free human being, had a very clear mind and was able to see in very detail, in an organized way, how we work, how the human being works, and how it works to become awestruck with sunsets and then crashing back into the little sense of self imprisoned in my ego. So he was able to teach how to observe ourselves functioning in the different ways that cause ourselves expansion and contraction, stress and struggle and pain and suffering and friendliness and generosity and the qualities which expand our hearts. He says, "My whole teaching is to teach the sure heart's release, the release from that little sense of prisoning ourselves in our little self-concern bubble." And one of the very first things we learn and that he teaches, sort of foundation thing he teaches, is mindfulness, which some of you, of course, have heard about. And mindfulness is this capacity that the human mind has, extraordinary capacity, to observe itself and see that there's different ways of seeing it, but the way I describe it these days is as though there are two minds simultaneously going on. There's the part of ourselves which thinks the little concerns about me and my this, and I must take a photograph of the sunset, that part of me. And then, sort of around the background of that, more shy and quiet, but way bigger, is awareness. Awareness that what it's doing. Awareness that it's feeling sad or irritated or happy or present. That's what we call awareness, that kind of like background knowing. Consciousness is another word for that. There are different uses of some of these words in more subtle aspects of the teaching, but that will do for tonight. The mind, and then awareness of the mind. mind which thinks, plans, comments, judges, compares, organizes things, fixes things. And then this quieter awareness all around it, rather like stars and then space surrounding the stars. Thoughts, the mind thinking thoughts, and then awareness surrounding that process. Only when we're in the present moment, when our attention is applied to the present moment, can we access that consciousness, of that awareness, that knowing what's happening. And what happens to us so often is our minds take us into thoughts about the experience, rather than experience itself, but thoughts about experience, stories, descriptions, comments, which take us out of being in the present moment, which reduce access to this awareness. The point that we want and why we practice mindfulness is to grow and sustain access with functioning of this awareness, this superior, if you like, vast consciousness, knowing. We're very good at thinking about and planning, and we don't need to practice that part. And we want to even withdraw energy from doing so much of that, because it interferes with a little bit of thinking, some light thinking, and needing, we need to make thoughts and plans, oh yes, I must remember to do this and that. It's not that we shouldn't do that, but the thinking part of our mind gets so predominant that it masks the other, which is where our wisdom is, but it's shy, and so it gets outshouted, outshadowed. So mindfulness. As we become mindful, as we become increasingly in the present moment, well, what we do is we use anchors of something, noticing something which is in the present moment to help us be present so that we can access awareness. It's not about the anchors, it's about using them as a means to help us be present. So we use the body, and there's all different ways. I just taught you one this evening, but there's many different ways of noticing different parts of the body which can help us stay in the present moment. It's not the only way to stay in the present moment. We can notice, when we're present, all kinds of things, and eventually we do. We notice our moods, we notice our changing states, we notice how a sensation has a certain feeling and a flavor, which makes us feel like something, which makes us get into a whole lot of thinking about something, and then making up a whole movie about something, and we can see this activity going on inside. The human mind can observe itself. It's amazing. And this is what the Buddha is recommending we do, asking us to do. If you want to be happy, observe how your mind helps you or hinders you from being happy, because it's going on in your mind. It's not what's going on to you in your world, it's how you are relating to that. So you need to start watching your mind and see how it works in there. Well, when you start watching your mind and seeing how it works in there, in all different circumstances and changing, we start to see, we start to understand how we're functioning. Even though the instructions aren't telling us what to do about how we're functioning, they're saying, watch your mind. Be present with the help of your body. Access this big, quiet awareness that will see clearly. It's like being, one of the descriptions for being mindful, the Buddha said, was being up on top of a tower. When you're on top of a tower and you can see the village around, you have a kind of overview of what's happening. But sort of mindfulness is like having an overview of what's going on in your mind. When you're not on the tower, you're in the village, and then you're in your thoughts, and you're in your dramas, and you're in your worries, and you're absorbed in it, and there's no overview possible. There's no mindfulness, no consciousness possible of it. You're just, we call it identified with your thinking, or your worrying, or your anger, whatever it may be, you get caught in. We can have mild amounts of thinking and not be caught, but they can get too big for themselves, and then we lose our awareness, and we get consumed by them. We even have that in our English language, consumed by desire, overcome by grief, carried away by emotion, in the grip of fear, etc. Meaning we've lost consciousness at that time, the overview part. We aren't bad to have it happen, it's just that when we're lost like that, caught like that, we don't have any chance of making any choices about what to think, what to say, ask any questions, because that part is the wisdom part, and that's now just, we've lost touch of that. So we're caught simply triggered by whatever the situation is to either be excited or upset, and then that's what we are, and that's what we do, and that's what we say from that limited place, not from a place of understanding with any kind of space to make some choice about would that be a good idea to say that thing or to speak in a certain way or to keep thinking in this kind of direction. There's none of that is possible to choose when we don't have that awareness. So we want to have that awareness so we can function in a more appropriate way. So there's this progressive teaching. It's just a clever way of seeing how meditation transforms our consciousness. The more we see, the more we understand, the less caught we are, the more we're able to have that spacious awareness, and from that, the more skillfully and kindly and producing happiness and well-being we are. And it's a four-part developmental model, which is very interesting, I find. And it popped into my mind this evening to share with you. It's these four different states. One is called unconscious incompetence. You know this, Joyce, remember? Anyway, the next one is conscious incompetence. And the next one is conscious competence. And the last one is unconscious competence. And I'll explain that. So first, we're unconsciously incompetent, which simply means we don't have any mindfulness, we have no conning tower advantage point, we have no awareness of what's happening, we are at the mercy of what's happening, somebody insults us and we are insulted and that's it, and we responded in whatever way we would if somebody had just insulted you. How dare you? We fight back or we shrink or we collapse or whatever it is we do. That's not particularly helpful, it's not exactly competent, but we don't even know that we're doing it, we're just reacting. Unconscious incompetence. As we meditate, we grow more access to our consciousness, to our awareness. This being in this more spacious, slightly back from the drama in the audience position, another description of mindfulness, quiet compared to the constant, oh, I don't know, I like this, I want that, remember, churning that goes on from the little state. It's sort of more quiet, oh, I see, that's what's happening. That's more like mindfulness functioning. We recognize that we are irritated, or we are bored, or we are judgmental, or we're critical, or unworthy, or whatever the state that we're feeling, we recognize. We're having those states. They're probably not necessary, appropriate, or helpful, but now we know we're having them because we're becoming more conscious. This mindfulness meditation practice, simply be present, do nothing in particular, observe your breathing, observe different things. I didn't give you other things to observe, but we can observe moods changing, we can observe different parts of our body, different sensations in the body elsewhere, we can observe sounds and so on, sights. As this consciousness grows, we get more access to it and it becomes more available on a longer term basis, like for longer periods. We will start to really see how our minds do what they do, how neurotic they actually are. It's a very discouraging phase. It's like, you're kidding, I can't believe how many times in the last 15 minutes I blame myself, for instance, or something. We often need teachers to point it out to begin with, and that's embarrassing, and then we see it for ourselves, and then we think, oh, I can't, my mind is just never able to be stable for a second. It's this completely unruly thing, and I've been meditating now for 10 years, and I can't believe how, blah, 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 I still am, etc. This is consciousness of our incompetence, of the waywardness of our mind, of the lack of good behavior of our mind, if you like, because even though the mind can observe the mind, when a mind is untrained, we can see it behaving like an unruly puppy. You can just see it doing it. You sit there and you think, I was here for about, you know, quarter of a second, and then I was in Paris, and then I was worrying, and then I was here, and my mind isn't doing what I want it to do. As we grow in meditation, and the mind gets more disciplined, it gets more present, it gets more steady and calm, it doesn't want to keep running off and jumping off and being neurotic and blaming ourselves and complaining. It just does it less because it's able to see the behavior it's exhibiting is painful and is not helpful and is exhausting and is ridiculous some of the time. It says things which is crazy, it's not true. And we start to recognize all this stuff. And what happens, and it's almost, it happens, it isn't that you make it happen, but we start to see that I could stop that sentence. If that sentence is an irritating sentence, a judgmental, a critical sentence, I can, in the middle of it, and I don't want to say that thing. I'm not going to finish saying what I was saying. It's not going to do any good. It's pointless. I'm not going to do it, for instance. We start being able to be conscious about our behavior, and we start being able to make some choices. When we're mindful, we're much more... We're much less out of control. We're more in control. Control is not a good word, but we're more able to choose, let's say, instead of just on automatic reactivity triggered. We're able to make choices. The mind starts to be this interesting instrument that we have that shows us and reveals us things. We begin to see through it and understand. Initially, we can't see it. We can't see through it. It just thinks its thoughts, and you believe the thoughts it thinks. It tells you things that I've always said this. I don't know why I say this one, but it always comes into my mind that your neighbor is an idiot for playing, you know, running the chainsaw at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning. It tells you these stories about, and you believe it. It has this running commentary, and you believe it. As we practice, you realize it's just a commentary that your thoughts are thinking. It isn't actually the truth. It's just an opinion. We begin to realize that's not a statement of fact that that person's an idiot. It's just an opinion that my mind has at the moment, which can easily change. I have an encounter with this neighbor and I discover they're charming or something. They're not an idiot. They're actually brilliant. Or whatever. You know, the mind, the way it tells us information, we start to see through. We're not so convinced. So this change that then happens through being able to observe the mind and keep being present is we start being able to function in a way that we'd rather function in. Instead of being this sort of out of control victim of circumstance, we start being able to make choices about how to do what we want to do. So here's a story. I've told this story a lot of times, but it's an example. It's a comparative two situations. I've told it in this very room, I know. This was years ago, but it's a very good example of unconscious incompetence and then conscious competence. Unconscious incompetence example, two Irish housewives in the times of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, we're talking like 12, 14 years ago now, or so, maybe more, were walking down the road and they'd been out for their morning grocery shop and they were walking along the same piece of pavement and they were opposing each other and they got to each other. It was a narrow sidewalk. And one was a Protestant and one was a Catholic. And neither of them would get off the sidewalk for the other one to pass. They refused. They just have so little respect of each other and such animosity that they just wouldn't budge. And they just stood there. And they started saying things and then hurling insults. And then people began to gather around them. And then there was a crowd. And then there was more hurling of more insults until there was hurling of rocks. And eventually a gun was shot and somebody was killed. They didn't know what they weren't intending to have anyone killed, but their just automatic resistance to each other and opposition to each other escalated out of control. That's incompetent behavior, you would say, coming home from shopping. So here's another example. And it happened around the same time. And it was I don't know when it was, 2004 or so, if anyone might remember who lived in the East, there was this ice storm in the East. It was really bad in Quebec. Does anybody remember when it was? Anyway, it was somewhere back there, you know, 14 years ago or something. And same sort of era. And in the ice storm, it was really dangerous to go out because all of the wires had cut, you know, ice on them were dropping and branches from trees were dropping. And it was really very difficult. And it was cold in people's houses for a long time, if you remember that part. And two women, housewives, had to go out in this storm. And they were driving, and one had to go because her daughter was in labor and she had to go join her in the hospital, and the other one had to go because her father had a heart attack or something and had to go to the hospital. Right? So they're driving along on the same road in opposite directions, and they meet each other. And the reason they stop in their cars and meet each other is because there's a tree down across the road. And they both get out and they talk to each other and they explain what their situation is, and they both get into the other person's car and they drive off to go and do whatever they need to do. That's conscious competence. They chose a way that was skillful out of their predicament, rather than they couldn't choose a way that was, and they ended up acting inappropriately. So there's an example of the possibility. As we meditate more, we'll find ourselves more like the Canadians than the Irish housewives in that story. And that just continues to grow. And what happens as time passes with more practicing and more awareness growing is that behavior of cooperation, of empathy, of listening skills, of not wanting to harm people by insulting them or resist them on the sidewalk or whatever the thing is, becomes naturalized. It becomes the default setting. Wisdom, caring, kindness, understanding, clarity, calm becomes increasingly established in the system, so it no longer is deliberate. It's no longer necessary to try and be nice or to listen well or to have some kind of groundedness. We have more and more of it the more we practice. So our competence becomes an automatic thing. We are then friendly. We are then appreciative. We are then calm and less reactive. So it moves from unconscious incompetence, which is untrained minds just triggered, to consciousness of that, embarrassingly so, but necessary to be able to see it. And then we begin to have some choices, some space, some ability, some control, some mastery over the mind instead of the mind running us ragged. And that becomes integrated, and it becomes integrated in our systems. Wisdom becomes established. We make choices which are appropriate. Anything else isn't even a consideration as time passes. And it's an ongoing thing, lifelong thing. Doesn't that sound nice?
Lovely.
Isn't that why you're here? Isn't that part of a way of describing what we're doing? The Buddha called it the sure heart's release, or freedom from suffering, or awakening, or enlightenment, or ease of well-being. If you're incompetent and you don't know it, you're going to have ease of well-being, but you're going to be miserable and you're going to be bumping into the world all the time. And you'll have moments of remorse and then, oh well, and you'll go and drown yourself in your sorrows or whatever it is you do. When you become conscious of your incompetence, it's challenging and you need a lot of kindness and a lot of patience. And we need to realize it's not me failing. It's a mind that doesn't realize what it's doing. It's a mind that thinks if it gets excited or angry or blames people, it'll help itself somehow. We start to realize it doesn't do such a great job of that. So we have to see the incompetences that we do. We won't not do them if we don't see them. And it isn't just that we want to see them. We want to experience what it's like and stay in that experience when I just judged or just freaked out about something or just been whining for the last 10 minutes. What's it like to sit here whining? It's actually not very pleasant. It certainly isn't giving me the ease of well-being. It's like I'm complaining all the time about everything. I'm frowning and churning and wishing I weren't here and wishing that things were always different. Look at that, how much I do that. And then as we're more present, that's what's so amazing, we'll see that we're not incompetent all the time. Sometimes we're incompetent, sometimes we're more competent. It's just a way of describing. Sometimes we function in a calm, friendly, sort of sensible sort of way. And that feels different from when we're whining. And as we're conscious of these differences and what's going on inside, it's the experience of well-being associated with more competence that really shows up the pain of the incompetent states. And the more we compare the difference, because we're living the difference, not just seeing it, but experiencing it, the more our whole systems are going to go for friendliness and calm and clarity and mindfulness. We want more of it. We don't want to keep losing it and get carried away by whatever it is we got carried away by. We regret that. We can't help but be miserable in those states. And so it's the very willingness to look at ourselves, look at our inner activity, mental behavior, states, how they're changing, what they're doing, and what they're causing, willing to see that, that will show you your own way, your own habits, your own tendencies, your own situation in the moment. You will learn by your own mind's behavior. It will teach you which way is more competent and which then feels freer and more expanded, more peaceful. And so you can't not move in the direction of freedom if you're willing to look. But you have to keep move. You have to move through those things, and part of what you're going to see is incompetence, your rowdiness, your embarrassing pieces. You're going to have to face remorse. And one of the reasons why meditation isn't super popular is because people don't want that part. They want to move from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence without the interim steps, and it doesn't work. If it could, we would all have done it already. We would all just, okay, I'm going to wish myself into being a saint, and then I've done it. Mm-hmm. But we don't, can we? You know, we'd like to be that way. We try, and then up comes some family member that says that old thing that they always do, and oh, and I just lose it again. So, you know, if we could do it by thinking ourselves there, it would be, we'd be different. Life would be different, but they're habits of mind, habits of perception, delusions of consciousness, as Einstein says. And so we need to actually grow new pathways, new neural pathways, new habits of seeing in the mind. And it's a slow growth. It's an ongoing, lifelong exploration and journey. But it increasingly lightens the load of living. That's the thing to say about it. The more we become conscious, and the more competent we become, the more fun it is, and the more sweet it is, and the more friendly it is, and the easier it is. And without it, it's heavy drag, and because we keep bumping into people, and people keep hurting us, and we keep getting upset. Ugh, it's hard. Because life is not itself easy. I mean, life is lovely, and then it isn't, and then people are nice to us and not, and then they come, and then they go, and then people get sick, and things happen, and we're not in charge of all that up and down. So that alone is challenging, being human. We don't know when the next, you know, foot will land, or, you know, something will fall from the sky, or a president will be elected, or what. We're not in charge of what's happening, but we can learn to be more competent with it, in how we deal with it and respond. And so we must, if we want to be happier, then it's up to us. It's our own life, and we can, actually. And it does get to be a flowier, more graceful, more forgiving, more flexible, and much more understanding, much more compassionate, much more empathetic. Instead of you're good, you're bad, I'm bad, oh, we don't like, judge. It's edgy and heavy to be the way of unconscious incompetence. Even conscious incompetence is unpleasant. So that's what I have to say. And I'm tired this evening because I was talking all day. And the day before, I wasn't all day. We were meditating, but I was teaching a retreat. So what I'd really like is I'd like you to ask me questions or make comments about this. And how does that work for you? And so I'm happy to talk, but I'm good at, if you just ask me a question, you press button 3 and I'll answer that. It's what I would like. I'd like to hear from you a little. What about these four competences? What do you think? Sandra, what do you think?
I think the way you've described them sounds like linear, but my experience is that you think you're getting there and then suddenly you'll fall back into unconscious incompetence.
Absolutely.
On something, you know.
It's true. It's not linear, you're right. I'm glad you said that. But it's like widening circles or something.
Yeah.
And there is more and more time spent with more and more consciousness and lightness, but it isn't like, you know, the next day in the next day. It's not, no, unfortunately, nothing is in a straight line in the way we live. But there is nevertheless this emerging or expanding or lightening.
Yes, you spend more time in a conscious state.
That's right, than the unconscious state. But you keep falling in holes. There's that.
So those family members.
Especially with family members. there's that little thing, what's it called? Something in 5 short chapters. Does anybody know what the title is?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know what the title is, something in five short chapters. I walk down the sidewalk, there's a deep hole, I fall in, I have no idea how I fell in, I'm in there for a long time thrashing around, I find my way out. Chapter two, I walk down the road, there's a hole in the sidewalk, I fall in the hole. I did know there was a hole, I don't know how I got in there, I get out quickly. Chapter three, I walk down the road, there's a hole in the sidewalk, I trip in it and I hop out right away. Chapter four, there's a hole in the sidewalk, I walk around the hole. Chapter five, I go down a different road. That's the same kind of thing. But it isn't as linear as that, because we keep finding ourselves back in the hole again. But we do get out quicker and quicker,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
As we get more competent. Yeah. Hi.
But in the future or in your own practice, sometimes there is a possibility that they are born to falling back, I guess.
Yes.
So that's what I think that drives us.
That's right.
In the practice.
That's right, that's the motivation, because actually we do become better at it. But still we fall. But even if we fall, and even when we fall, it's a lighter fall.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for so long, it's not so heavy, we don't blame ourselves so terribly, it's not so dramatic. It's like, oh, did it again, oh well, kind of. It's so, we don't take it so personally, it's not so dramatic. Whereas initially everything is so intense and it's so dramatic and oh, I am just awful, and you know, it's very like heavy. So, but it's it's lighter and softer and more gentle, and that's what keeps us practicing exactly. And you see it yourself; you know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know that there is less time that you get triggered by somebody or confused by something, and you quicker, much more easily, can forgive yourself or understand yourself or have compassion for the situation instead of getting so embroiled.
They're more skillful, I guess.
More skillful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less sticky. And it gets, you know, the tangles are less dense and they, you know, less confounding for less time.
You might want to take a step back once in a while, though, just to get an adrenaline rush.
Bruce, oh, I don't know how well you know Bruce, but he always comes up with a let's just pull the rug out comment. Yeah, you don't want to get bored in your ease, you mean. Don't worry.
Okay.
And anyone could ask me anything that's not on that exactly same topic if you don't, if you'd like.
How long have you been practicing?
Oh, so I'm 60, soon be 68, and I came to Canada when I was 20. And when I was 21, I started doing transcendental meditation, but I don't remember much about it. I didn't really know what I was doing. And when I was 23, I started meditating 2.5 hours a day with a devotional practice with an Indian Sikh guru. So for 4 years, I practiced for 2.5 hours a day, and I went for 3 months or something like that to India, to the ashram, and meditated 8 hours a day, at the end of which I realized that I wasn't actually a devotee. And I didn't want that kind of meditation where you're supposed to concentrate till you have a light in the third eye, and then you turn it into the Maharaji, and then you merge on the inner planes with the Maharaji, which was the plan. And I was like, I don't really want to merge with this. He was a nice man. It was nothing, it wasn't a problem, you know, cultish kind of thing. He was a very well-respected and lovely human being. It just wasn't my thing, I didn't think. And so when I came back from that, I was in an unhappy relationship with no support whatsoever, the opposite. So it kind of stopped. But I started reading Zen. I would be about 26 or 7 by then. I started reading Zen books and liked them, but didn't ever take any Zen training. Then for 4 years, I did very little in the way of meditation. I was doing a lot of yoga because I had a baby, moved to Salt Spring, had a stepdaughter, was busy in the family way, sketchy bits of meditation, until my relationship fell apart. And I had a friend going to do a 10-day retreat. So this was now in 81. So I was, whatever that is, 32. And so then I went to a 10-day retreat. And then for the next 8 years, I did 10 of those 10-day retreats through the 80s. And then I, with Goenka, some of you may have heard the name. Goenka is an Indian man who teaches a form of Vipassana, particular aspects of the practice, very intensive. And you sit from 4 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night with no walking, and it's just sitting. So I did all that through the 80s. That was my 30s. And then at the end of the 80s, I met some Western teachers. And so I started sitting still Vipassana, but was taught by people from my own culture, in my own idiom, using relevance in their explanations that actually made sense to me, because I stopped listening to the Indian man because I couldn't really relate very well. I practiced, though. I did a lot of the meditations. And so since '88, I started sitting with Western Vipassana teachers, and but it was a single mother, and so it wasn't until the early 90s, my son was old enough that I could do longer retreats. I started then in the 90s to do like 6-week long retreats, 3-month long retreats. In the Y2K period, that winter, I did a 4-month retreat in England, and at the end of that, I was invited by Jack Kornfield to be in his teacher training program. So that was in 2000. I started the teacher training 2001. It was a 4-year training. So I've been actually teaching now since 2003, mm-hmm. something like that. Practicing since then. So a long time. Not so long time.
Mm-hmm. So is there a book on what you just talked about for that last?
There's many books. There's so many books. Okay. And there's too many books. I don't even know where to begin with books. But I'll give you a couple of names. There's a book which for beginning people, two, I really like three. One is called Buddhism Without Beliefs, and it's by an Englishman called Stephen Batchelor, and it explains kind of mindfulness, how it works. And another one is called Mindfulness in Plain English. It's written by a Sri Lankan monk. And both of them really explain like why we want to practice mindfulness and what mindfulness is and how it really helps us. Very well, easy to read. And a third book, which is goes further into the practices, different aspects of them, but it's very good, is, I think, The Path with Heart by Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield is one of the Western teachers, he's the one who actually trained me as a teacher. And so The Path with Heart. I think those are great books, but there are many, many, and many others would have other ones to recommend. So you can't go wrong if you begin with those. Oh, thanks, Sandra. I speak from my own experience, and my own experience is that I'm not particularly cerebral. I mean, my mind works fast enough, and it's smart enough, and all of that, but I'm not an intellectual in my pursuit, and I always lived in the country, and I was always very sort of earth motherish, if you like, because I was a midwife for a long time. Grew my own food, I still do, things like that. So I never was an academic or went into that world particularly. And because of my experiences in meditation, particularly Buddhism, I did read a bit about Zen, which I liked. But then once I was a single mom and a midwife on call and growing food and trying to keep my life together, I'd go away and meditate whenever I could, but I wasn't really thinking about it and I certainly wasn't reading about it. I had really no idea. I just was meditating. And learning to be present and learning to concentrate my mind and to just become interested in what was going on inside. But I didn't really have any understanding. And it wasn't until the end of the 80s that I began to understand the teachings in terms of what the teachers were saying, and got to say, that Buddha guy, he really did understand how the mind works, because the way he describes it and the way they just taught it is exactly what happens to me. And so I kind of came at it not from my head but from practice. And then I started reading bits and pieces of things and found that they sort of confirmed my experience rather than explained it, in that I tried to then get it and put it into practice. I did the practice first. Now, I recommend it, because then it obviates that problem of thinking about something and then trying to get what that means for yourself. I really emphasize practice, the practical, actually seeing for yourself what's going on in your own mind and reading to support it and encourage you, but rather than head-led. That's because it worked so well for me. And it depends, we're all different, Some people are much more academic or love reading, and they learn a lot that way, and that's really helpful for people. So not to say we're all going to be like the way I did it, but nevertheless, it's the Buddha keeps emphasizing experience, experienced by the wise, practice, practice. Go and practice and see for yourself. He says, if you want to see how your mind works and how you create your own well-being and you get in the way of your own well-being, then watch your mind. Do it. Don't think about it or read about how someone else did it. Just do it yourself. Look. Sit down, be present, and watch what's going on in your own mind. And I tend to agree with him. I think he was a smart guy. I'm kidding. I mean, he was an incredibly brilliant teacher whose teachings have continued without a break, exactly as he taught them for 2,600 years. It's unbelievable. It's the oldest, extant teaching that hasn't changed all this time. It's amazing. So,
I think you'd be a great counselor.
Midwifery, you don't have to say so much.
So what is your daily practice like then?
It changes all the time. And what's happened in the last number of years is there are times where I apply myself to actually practicing something, but what goes on is that with more mindfulness, here's a description of this. This is a not quite right, but pretend it didn't have a flat bottom, but it's a bowl. And then take a ping pong. And the ping pong ball is your attention, is your ability to be present, your mindfulness. And you put it on top of a bowl that doesn't have a flat in it, and it can stay for a second and it rolls off. You may have noticed that tonight. And so the more you practice and you keep being present and it rolls off and you keep being present and it stays a bit longer, it's as though the bowl gets more and more shallow, and so that the urge to roll off is lessened. And with practice, it's as though that bowl becomes flat, and then you've got like a flat dish, and here's your ping pong ball of attention, your mindful attention, your present awareness, and it can go here, it'll stay here and stay here. Get a little bit of a tip in life and whoops, it goes off, but mostly it's much more easy to stay. With more practice, it becomes inverted, and so the tendency is to be more present. And still it's a bit tippy and you go off. And then with more and more practice, this is like the default setting, it's like becomes a bowl like this that doesn't have a flat base. It goes there, you're present. And then there may be certain times like family relations, for instance, which like whoop, and you lose it. But there's less and less of that. There's more of this conscious, unconscious competence of being present and aware. And so it's like everything becomes meditation. Meditation just means being present and aware. And when you're not, then you choose a time and a place which is not distracting, which is reassuring, where you're comfortable, and things aren't pulling your attention to help you get to the and stay there. And you use these various tools to help you stay there. But the more and more your mind is already there, the less and less you need to actually do things to make it do it. It'll just be there more. And so there are times then that I take periods, and sometimes I'm doing a lot of daily practice, and sometimes I'm just being quietly sitting or doing some yoga, walking, but I'm not thinking, I'm not lost in anything, I'm not having to train or keep myself here. And it's sometimes whether my eyes are open or closed, if I'm standing up or sitting down or lying down, it's like it's all meditation. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say all, but I'd say a lot more. And so once it happened in my awareness quite a few years ago, it's like I'm meditating, I'll be sitting here, and then I was like, I'm still meditating, and then I'd be standing up and I'd be washing the dishes, aren't she still meditating? I realized, oh, it isn't a separate thing to actually be meditating. But initially it is, because the mind isn't there. The awareness isn't there, so we train it like that. But it's a training, and it gets a bit better trained. And then at times I do intensive things at times, and I'm going to really pay attention to some aspect. That's what I like now. So I'll say, okay, there's some aspect, the way the Buddha taught, I really want to zero in on what this is. So for instance, a few years ago, this is an interesting thing to teach, and you're new. Buddha was so clever. So his mind was so fine. There are, one way to describe what it's like being a human being is any one or more than one of five states of mind, of awareness, which get in the way of being able to be present and aware. And they're called hindrances. Present, aware, concentrated, clear. They hinder us. One is when we are wanting something. I want something, I want something, and then we're ahead of ourselves and we're scheming and we can get really caught in whatever that may be, desire. The opposite feeling is like we don't like something. Oh no, this is awful. And we can get so caught in either a fear of something, or anger with something, or trying to get rid of something, or dealing with something, we spend our time meditating to begin with, just caught in these things. So resistance of some form or another, of many forms. Wanting and the opposite, not wanting, wanting it not. Then there's one which is called agitation, or restlessness, or squirminess, or I bet some of you were wishing I'd ring the bell sooner than I rang the bell, for instance. I kind of like can't quite sit here and be here like, oh God, do we have to do this much longer? Feeling, wanting to move out of your skin, or the mind just doesn't want to stay. It just keeps going all over. It's like quicksilver. There's many different ways we experience this restless. Sometimes it's because we're agitated or we feel some kind of bother. We're remorseful about something and, I just can't stand to be with myself. Any of that. And then its opposite, which is just dull. And so some of you maybe this evening, it's the evening. I had two nods, I have to say, when I'm sitting here this evening, realized I'm tired. It's been a day full for me. And there's this kind of like dullness or heaviness or sort of sludginess to the mind. Anyway, sinking mind, there's different ways. That's called torpor, or sloth and torpor is the traditional translation of that, Nivarana. And the fifth one, which is doubt, to be in a state where I don't really know if this is okay, if I'm doing this right, if I can do this, or, oh, I don't know if I'm ever going to get the hang of this, or I don't know what she said, and does she mean that, and is that true really? Or it's the state of being unsure, untrusting, and unable to take the next step because I don't know if this is okay, kind of hung up. And that's doubting. And these are five. And you can have, often you can have, I want this and I don't want this simultaneously. I don't want this, I want this. I don't want rain, I want sun, actually, both together. We can't have agitation and dullness in the same moment because they're really opposite. But we could have doubt. Doubt and wanting, or we can have agitation and wanting and doubt all together, for instance. So if you can have, you can have three, or you can even have four, one and two, three instead of four and five, one, two, three and five all together. That's called a multiple hindrance attack. And you know you get in them sometimes, right? When you're all really wound up. And so these hindrances. And so the Buddha was able to say, when any of these or more than any one of them is functioning, they're keeping our present awareness from being established. You know, we're caught up in some way, upset somehow, not seeing clearly in some way. So, to get back to what I was saying, not that long ago, I decided to explore doubt. And I decided to just come as conscious as I could of what doubt was like and when it was showing up in my mind at any time, all day long. And it was, for a year I did it. I was just really interested in how it manifests and discovered that it manifests almost all the time, except in moments when I'm completely in a sense of peaceful freedom. The reason that I want anything is because I doubt that it's okay without it, for instance. Mm-hmm. See? And, you know, the reason that I have any kind of urge to do anything, any sense of me needing anything or wanting to do anything about anything is because without that thing, I don't trust what things are. It's the opposite of trusting. When we are in a state of trusting, it's okay. It's, you know, this is going to happen and I'll deal with however I need to and it will happen in whatever way. It's not sort of abandonment of intelligence either, but it just means I'm not in conflict and feeling that I have to keep rearranging everything to make it all okay. Mm-hmm. I better get going and be okay or else it's going to be chaos. That's doubt. Mm-hmm. What should I? And often don't know what to do either. It's like, oh, I better do something. I don't know what on earth to do. That feeling of, that's doubt. It's all over the place, doubt. It's huge. I hadn't realized how profound it was, how it's kind of running the sense of self. And when it isn't there, there's no need to be a self and that who has to do anything about anything. Things so, just are as they are. So.
So if you're feeling that huge doubt and feeling like you have to do something, but you don't really have to, do you sit and meditate?
Well, the first thing to do is very good. The first thing to do is to recognize, oh, doubting. Doubting's happening. In fact, there's this hindrance hindering my consciousness. My consciousness is just consciousness. It's just awareness. And in it, there's this sense of what's actually happening is, in our experience, and you'll see it, is that this little busy part of my left hemisphere, which producing a bunch of thoughts, coming from this feeling of like, oh, I don't think so, I'm not sure, whatever, however you're experiencing, it's about experiencing that feeling of doubting. It's making the thoughts, I don't know what to do, I wonder if I should do this, I wonder if I should do this, what would happen if I did that? Oh, I don't know if that would be okay. All of those thoughts are being generated into the mind by this feeling, which is how thoughts get generated, and we believe all those thoughts. And I call that the little mind, and sometimes I call that my executive assistant, who's trying very hard to make me feel okay. Maybe we should do this, maybe you should do this, then you'd feel okay. You know, I don't know if you should do that, maybe that would be in trouble for you. Or it's kind of trying to, it's my agent, it's trying to take care of things. My little self. Meanwhile, the big self in the background, who's being outmaneuvered, if you like, by the noisiness of this little one, is saying, give it a try. Like, who knows what will happen? See what will happen. Wait and see. You don't know, so you don't know. Can you not know? Do you have to know everything? It's kind of allowing myself to live my life even if I'm uncertain. Whereas the doubt is like, I don't know if I should do this, what should I do? It's trying to do something. So the first thing we do is recognize the little mind is thinking all these thoughts and it's just telling all these stories. They're just stories. It's just an active assistant trying to be helpful. What you can do is say, thank you very much for being so helpful, but we've got it covered. Just knowing that you're doubting, you go from unconscious incompetence to consciousness. Doubting is running the show. And as soon as it's seen, it's not running you. Because you've extracted yourself from its influence. You're no longer in the grip of doubt. You're now aware of doubt. Doubt is a passing experience that's coming through. The Buddha called them visiting forces. The mind is pure and light and clear, except when it is visited by these different forces. So you don't have to think of it as me doing something wrong. It's just like, oh, look, this visiting force has come. As soon as it's recognized as that, no longer has it got you, it's running you. So you're no longer hindered. You're now aware of, oh, doubting, and it feels like this. So the next step, after recognizing it, is to say, well, what's that experience? Make that your present experience, because it is. So then you, with your present experience, particularly in your body, doubting, what does that feel like? When you recognize, oh, I'm really full of doubt, I'm really doubting, what's that feel like? And you stay right in the present moment, right in the body, right here, which is all there is anyway. The rest is all imagined. There isn't a future or later. That's just what we think. The reality, which is the Buddha's teaching of right here, right now, this moment, is tense and squirmy and like, ooh. You don't have to have words for it, but you, okay, what's it? And stay with that experience and feel what that is. It's unpleasant. It's scurrying. It's like, ooh. Pulling back. It's doing something across here. Whatever it is, just get in touch with your own experience right now. And all of a sudden, what's happening is your awareness is now functioning. And you're recognizing something that is true for you. Something that you're experiencing. A kind of state that you're experiencing. You're meditating. That's what meditating is. You could be walking down the street, but you're doing that. And you're seeing that's what's happening. And no longer are you acting unconsciously doing it, because now you're conscious. And when you're conscious, you'll be able to say, do I want to continue like this? Do I need to? I'm going to just count a few blessings and I'll feel a lot lighter. So suddenly you're consciously competent. Just from awareness in that moment. And then you see your sister and then you're right back in the hole again.
Which one?
It's so it goes. Just even recognizing that we have these visiting forces called hindrances that come in and cloud our awareness. Ah, that's such a huge relief to see it that way. It's not like I have to fix myself. It's my awareness can recognize what's going on. It's not personal. It's just this energetic process happening inside and I can start to understand. It's like mechanics. I can start seeing how it functions in there. Extraordinary. And it functions in, mine functions the same way yours functions. When I start seeing how this one functions, I realize how yours is functioning. And so I know when you're getting freaked out, or I know when you're getting tired or something. So then I start to relate to people with a lot more understanding, because I know what it's like being a human being. I know it very well, especially a doubting human being. I know that one really well. And so it's like, yeah, we're all in this together. So then we start, that's what compassion is. It's like having some empathy, being able to feel with each other. Instead of like, oh, I have an agenda and this is not working. And welcome.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you're in these states of hindrances, and when you're in it, you're experiencing it, right? So for instance, I experience it in my body. Like if I'm in discomfort, and my hindrance is wanting,
yes,
desire,
yes, yeah.
And I experience it in my body and I can feel it, and I'm holding my, let's say for instance, my heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in the experience, feeling it.
And you're aware at the same time.
Right. and the discomfort and being in the discomfort is discomforting.
Yes.
But when you make it past it, like I'm in this space right now where I can see that.
Yes.
As a almost like
pattern.
A pattern, absolutely. But almost like a past experience.
Okay.
How do you, the duration of it, there's no.
You're not in charge of that. It's life. And so if that's what's happening, that's what's happening.
Mm.
What we discover is we can actually tolerate up and down and shrinking and expanding
right.
and sweetness and falling into holes. And we realize that's what life's all about.
Right.
We just do it less and less clumsily and less incompetently and more
okay.
and more skillfully and helpfully
right.
as we live these lives. Because this plane, the human plane, is up and down and sideways and nowhere. It's what the Buddha called eight vicissitudes. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain and loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and ill repute. It's made up of these things.
Right.
This is the truth of this plane that we all live in.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is going to always be that way. We don't want that to be the truth. We want praise, fame, gain, and pleasure, period. And if the others are happening, there's something wrong, there's a mistake, we better hurry up and try and fix it so we can get to the four. And that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because it's ridiculous.
It's absolutely,
it's absolutely,
you can't experience any sort of pleasure
no.
if you don't experience the opposite.
And besides, it's always going to be all of it. We're going to have both. We're going to have pain and we're going to have loss and discomfort and everything. Okay, so you have some pain. There's desire and you see that that's painful and you have some displeasure. Okay.
Mm.
So what? So you have it, like, get over it. You know? Welcome to reality. Like,
yeah.
And so you can tolerate it without having to trigger into a whole lot of neurotic behavior that tries to fix. It's called rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Okay.
Bit of a waste of time.
Right.
And we begin to realize we don't have to work so hard to try and make it all be the way we think it ought to be so we'll be happy. We can just be with what's happening and find that there's some happiness in it, knowing that it's going to go down again and it's going to then go up again, and we don't know when or how because we're not in charge.
Right.
We can be surrendered to coping with it
mm-hmm.
and accommodating to the ups and the downs, and we enjoy the ups, but we don't have to have them and get all freaked out when they leave. And we can, like, we'll find the unpleasant stuff difficult and challenging and sad. And it's what it's like, though, being a human being. And, oh, this is tough times. Wow. Okay, here we go. Oh, this is tough. Oh, this is going to be really hard. Oh, okay, we can do this part. And then we move on. And then it's a little steady again. And so is the journey of life. We're learning to accommodate and be with it rather than trying to control it and get rid of this and get hold of that and keep this, and which is rope burn, basically. Anyone else? Anything else? Was this useful? Hope
yeah,
this is
sure.
helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Want to encourage you to be present. The whole point. And grow that. Just grow that as best we can. It's brilliant, magic, healing, helpful. And yet, it's still the planet, you know, it's still, we still have winter and summer and Trump, unfortunately. And we, if we can be more conscious, can be the most helpful people on the planet. You know, in whatever is happening, you know, whatever's happening with our little tiny piece, our little one human little piece, you know, that's our responsibility. And we can't do a lot about the big picture, but we do have some choice. If we can be conscious, we'll be able to make some helpful choices for ourselves and for those around us. So we must do that. That's all we have to do. We have to do that piece. It's like that serenity prayer. May I have the serenity? Somebody help me with the serenity prayer.
The
courage to change the things I can and the wisdom to know the difference. So let's have the serenity to tolerate what we can't change and the courage to do what we can, which is be more conscious. And out of that comes our wisdom and our kind choices. So that's why we sit. And we don't just do it because it's our responsibility. We know, and we dedicate our evening together and all of the time we sit, those moments when we're more present, we dedicate them to everyone and all beings everywhere, because we're not islands and we're not isolated. And whatever's happening in your consciousness in any moment is actually beaming outwards. and affecting everyone around you. We can't keep ourselves to ourselves. It's an energetic radiance that's happening. So let our radiance be more helpful and be more sensitive and be more respectful and more receptive. So as we practice together, it's actually our gift. So may there be benefit way outwards from this room for our being here together this evening. Nice to meet you. Thanks for being here together, letting me blather on about the Dharma, which I love to do.